I'm up here because I'm not sure who the scripture reader is. I don't mean to move in on his territory, but if he still wants to come up, do it. No? Okay. Appreciate the presence of everyone here this evening. There are some visitors. We appreciate your presence. Delighted in your desire to be to worship with us. What we're doing is continuing a series of lessons. We're in the fifth of six concerning the case for creation, looking at the various laws of science, some of them anyway, and asking ourselves which model do they fit better with, the creation model or the evolutionary evolution model. The scientific principle we're looking at this evening has to do with the law of probability, and it does figure in a few places in the scriptures, although I don't think we think of it that way. From Proverbs 16:33, the lot is cast in the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. This is one of those things that I believe the way the Jews handled it, in the way God wanted it, it wasn't carried to extremes. In fact, the casting of lots is very minimal. We are not sure what a lot is. It's like the Urim and Thummim. It's never described in the scriptures, almost as if God said there's going to be a time where you're not going to go that way anyway. The last time it is used is in the New Testament in Acts, the first chapter, which shows us pretty much how the Jews approached it as they were picking the next apostle after Judas was gone. We find out that they did everything possible to find out who would be an appropriate and worthy replacement for him. And when it came down to two, and it was beyond them to decide, you know, which was the better candidate, then the lot was cast and the final decision was left to God. And that's the way we find it in the Old Testament too. Pretty much they did everything God told them to do. They tried to come up with the best choice, and failing that, then they turned to God to find out which way to go. Which means that even in our introductory look here, there are things just beyond men, what we get into this stuff, in laws of probability, as it takes us beyond being able to figure out what's going to happen because there's too many variables. Some have renamed a lot of this stuff the chaos theory. You got a lot of that in Jurassic Park. But yeah, it just shows that life is complicated. And for the most part, nowadays, you know, God does give us direction in just about everything. I'm fudging it with just about. Peter said there's been given to us all things pertaining to life and godliness, so we really don't need to take these kind of measures in order to figure out what to do. But we're getting into it with the lesson this evening. One of the limitations of science is that it's, by its very nature, it deals not with absolute proof. Some people don't think of it this way, but this is why they call it the theory of evolution, because there's no absolute proof for it. It deals not with absolute proof, but with probability. In a widely used biological text by G.G. Simpson, the student is warned, we speak in terms of acceptance, confidence, and probability, not proof. You know, this is from a science book. Okay? In fact, the quotation goes on, if by proof is meant the establishment of eternal and absolute truth open to no possible exception or modification, then proof has no place in natural science. Okay. It's all left of a weight, which is what we're looking at, the weight of evidence. Is the weight of evidence for evolution, or is it for creation? And so far in the first four lessons, we see that the weight of evidence is, you know, tipping the scale toward, you know, creation. Today, almost every scientific discipline is based on the laws of probability. At the outset of any discussion of probabilities, however, two questions arise. First, are probabilities of any practical nature? when I was taking a statistics class, they wanted to bring out just how much it is used. They were using statistics in order to figure out, say, in war, you know, if you've captured two tanks and you look at the serial numbers, you can factor in the mathematics and kind of figure out just how many tanks were manufactured. And you can know the strength of the opposite army. So it does have practical nature. Second, are probabilities of any usefulness in the creation-evolution controversy? The answer is yes. James Kopedge, a former director of probability research, has stated probability is a practical concept. The uncertainties of chance affect our everyday lives. And this is, you know, one of the things we get into. You know, as you step out the door in the morning, there are so many variables and factors and things going on. There's no way to predict exactly how the day is going to go. And so it's no use to, you know, if something bad happens, to go, well, if I'd only done this instead of this, you know, whatever. Don't even go there. You know, it was beyond your capability to kind of figure it out anyway. And this is why where the creation model comes in. We really want to leave all that to God. And actually, he kind of takes away some of the probability factors. Okay, he doesn't leave it to chance. He is in control of things. As to the nature of probability, Dr. Borel, ever the practical mathematician, remarked that the principles on which the calculus of probabilities is based are extremely simple. And as intuitive as the reasonings which lead an accountant through his operations. So although it looks weird and, you know, beyond our grasp, it can be reduced to calculations. You know, this is what statistics does. King and Reed, in their excellent work, Pathways to Probability, stated, we see that the theory of probabilities is at bottom only common sense reduced to calculation. So if something doesn't feel like it's right, you know, chances are it isn't. Indeed, whether most people realize it or not, our daily lives are affected by such mathematical studies, sometimes in ways we do not even know or understand. Harold Morowitz, former professor of biophysics at the Yale University, commented, often a process is so complicated, we are so ignorant of the boundary conditions or the laws governing the process that we are unable to predict the result of the process in any but a statistical, you know, fashion. However, it goes on to say randomness is in a certain sense a consequence of either the ignorance of the observer, yet randomness itself, you know, displays certain properties which have been turned into powerful tools in the study of the behavior of, you know, at least the system of atoms. Since probability studies deal with randomness, and since evolution in its entirety is built upon the very concept of randomness, it would appear that the laws of probability would shed some light on the possibility of evolution having occurred. Unfortunately, no. Evolution is an ideal subject in which to apply the laws of chance. Evolutionary doctrine denies advanced planning. It has random matter in motion as its basic source. Chance mutations furnish the variability on which presently accepted evolutionary thinking in America is generally founded. Again, Mr. Kopelich. In the next section, we're looking at the evolution statistically probable. Okay, so we're looking at laws of probability of being able to be applied to randomness and stuff. But what does it do for evolution? Again, back to Borel. Borel's law of probability states that occurrences of any event where the chances are beyond 1 and 1 followed by 50 zeros is an event that we can state with certainty will never happen. So as you go, well, this thing has a chance of 1 in, okay, you can have 1 in 10, 1 in 20, but when it gets up to 1 in 50 zeros, forget it. No matter how much time is allotted, and no matter how many conceivable opportunities could exist for the event, it's still not possible. Dr. Morowitz estimated that the probability for the chance of the formation of the smallest, simplest form of living organisms, like bacteria, known is one chance followed by 340 million zeros. Okay, so for life to even start, you're way beyond 50. The late Carl Sagan estimated that the chance of life evolving in any given single planet, like the Earth, is one chance in that's one chance out of one followed by 2 billion zeros. So slowly the smart people of evolution and everything else, you know, have done their number crunching and told us, you know, that this is the chance of life starting on a planet like Earth. I guess they were unaware of Borel's law, you know, because after you go past the 50 zeros, you know, there's no chance. Numbers this large are so infinitely beyond one followed by 50 zeros that according to Borel's law of probability, there's absolutely no chance that life could have evolved spontaneously on Earth. I'm going to run through the rest of it. All you need to know is it keeps talking about big numbers way beyond 50 zeros. I'm not going to bore you with it, and I'm not sure I understand all of it anyway. Just know that the numbers, you know, are way beyond the scale of looking at this. So the problem is that any living cell or any new organ to be added to any existing animal, even the simplest imaginable, replicating the system, would have to contain far more stored information than represented by even such gigantic numbers as 10 to the 170th. Okay? There's no space for this kind of randomness. Marcel Golay, a leading information scientist, calculated the odds against such a system organizing itself as 10 to the 45th to 1. Salisbury set the figure at 10 to the 415th. Consequently, it can be concluded that the chance of origin is utterly impossible, or the chance origin of life. In view of this, then, which model is logically possible? R.W. Kaplan, who spent years researching the possibility of evolutionary life of Earth, suggested that the probability of the simplest life organism being formed by chance processes was one chance in 10 to the 130th. Then he stated, "One can conclude from this result that life could not have originated without a donor of information." Okay. So even if you discount Borel's law, the other researchers are pretty much saying the same thing. The numbers are too big, at least as furnished by the evolutionists. Creationists suggest that donor was the creator and that the evolutionary model cannot circumvent basic laws of probability. You know, it needs an outside donor working with the system in order to bring things about. It can't happen by chance. Evolutionist Richard Dawkins once observed, "The more statistically improbable a thing is, the less we can believe that it just happened by blind chance." Now, this is an interesting quote because Dawkins is the biggest mouth for evolution. He's written 7 books on it, poo-pooing God and whatever. But Dawkins is also the one in the movie Expelled that Ben Stein interviewed. And his final comment was, he says here, superficially the obvious alternative to chance is an intelligent designer. And he said to Ben Stein, "I believe in an intelligent designer." Now it sounds like he's promoting God, but then he went, "But I believe that intelligent designer is aliens." Okay. Which kind of circumvents the question still, well, where did the aliens come from? The problem with the distorted thinking of the evolutionists is that when you state that something has one chance in, they see the one and not the other numbers. So as long as you give them a one, they go, "Oh, it can happen." For them, it means there is a chance no matter what. But Sproul, Gesner, and Lindsley concluded, the fact is, and they're authors of a biology book, The fact is, however, we have a no-chance creation. We must erase the one which appears above the line of the one followed by a large number of zeros. Forget the one. There's not a chance. In fact, what the real chances of a universe created by chance, not a chance. Play on words, but specifically, yeah, there's not a chance that this universe could have evolved itself. Chance is incapable of creating a single molecule, let alone an entire universe. Why not? Because chance is nothing or no thing. It has no entity, has no being, no power, no force. It can affect nothing, for it has no causal power within it. It has no itness to be within. Give you when we think of odds, chances, or whatever, we could think of a billiard table. Okay, you have a person with a cue stick, and he's got a billiard ball, and he's got a stack of balls. And so he hits the cue ball as hard as he could and hits the stack. And what are the odds or the chance of all those balls going into the various pockets? Not one left on the table. Okay. Now, you can calculate that, or come up with a chance or probability. But what this is saying is, first of all, chance has no causal effect. So first of all, you have to take out the cause that begins all this, these balls moving in, randomly in motion. So take away the guy with the cue stick. Don't let him hit the ball. Now, you can look at that table and those balls are going to sit there for eternity unless there's an earthquake. Okay. But now also take away the balls. Take away the table. Take away the pockets. So there's nothing left but chance. Abstract concept. That chance has nothing to it. How can it predict or do anything? Because you've eliminated all the things it works with. Left by itself, there's nothing to figure. There's no balls in motion. There's no guy hitting them. And that's the beginning of our universe for the evolutionists. There's nothing in the universe. So how can chance cause anything, because there's no atoms, to ping off other atoms or whatever and start accumulating or building something? Claude Trestamont, eminent philosopher of science from the University of Paris, stated, "No theory of chance can explain the creation of the world." See, there are scientists out there, very smart people, that don't really believe in evolution, or even if they do, they do it just as, because everybody else does. But when they make statements, they got to be true to their science. Before chance can send atoms whirling through infinite void, the atoms have to exist. Okay, he just said the same thing I did. There has to be something there for chance to be a part of it. Mathematician Murray Eden, in his defense, said, so he's trying to justify evolution and this chance bringing everything into creation. But look how he does it. The randomness postulate is highly implausible. Not definitely impossible, but highly implausible. Okay, so he's starting to fudge, to begin with. And that adequate scientific theory of evolution must wait the elucidation of new natural laws, physical, physiochemical, and biological. What's he saying? Well, by the admission of its supporters, the only way that a theory can be accepted and propagated is by the elucidation of a completely new natural laws in the physical, chemical, and biological sciences. Or in other words, we'd have to change science. All the laws we have that you learn as you go through biology and physics and everything else, every one of those has to be trashed in order to be able to prove the theory of evolution. In fact, you have to wait for something to create a totally different universe with totally different laws, that don't have things like gravity and a certainty of certain experimental lines and stuff, in order for evolution to have any grounds or any traction to be proved. That's what the experts are saying. That's their last fallback. We've got to wait until the whole universe changes, or hope that it was a totally different place than it is now. But under the current science, with the rules and laws that we have, not one of them supports evolution. But they do stack up to the probability of an intelligent designer for the universe around us. The logical impossibility of holding to such a theory under the present natural laws hardly needs further comment. Evolution is such a theory and should therefore be rejected because it is impossible, both probabilistically and logically. Okay. Intuitively, you know, it doesn't make sense. We said at the beginning of this, evolution is accepted not because on the grounds that, oh, they presented all this empirical logic and facts and everything else. Evolution was grabbed onto because men didn't want to believe in God. That's the primary reason. And even the beginning ones still had a tough time not believing. Darwin believed in God. In fact, the degree that Darwin had was not in science. It was in theology. His dad was a minister. And so he was struggling through all this stuff, whether to accept the evolution. In fact, he wasn't the one that pushed it. You know, it was friends of his, that came along and, they thought it was, the greatest things that sliced bread. And so they're the ones that pushed it in the universities and stuff. For us, there's a lot of things that, are consequences of our thinking. And this is the rub and the problem. And why we have to fight against a lot of this. Whatever you think, it does have consequences. If you believe that you came from apes or lower forms of animals, you're going to behave like it. If you believe that you are the offspring of God, created in His image, and that there is a judgment day, and you're going to be held accountable for the way you behave yourself in this life, you're going to behave a lot better than someone who doesn't believe in God. Now, a lot of times scientists say, no, well, we can have morals also. Okay, but where are you going to get them from? There's too many people in this culture right now that are trying to tell us what's right or wrong, and they haven't the foggiest idea of where to start from. These people don't know anything about morals. They don't know what's right and what's wrong. We get our sense of right and wrong from what God teaches us. He's the one that tells us. In fact, people may say, well, let conscience be your guide. You can't do that. God is the one through the scriptures who actually begins to mold your conscience to let you know what's right and what's pure and just and all this. Without God, that all goes into the trash can. Anything goes, you might say. And our culture is beginning to show it. The people that think they're so smart and they know how to do things are showing that they don't know anything and they have no right to rule the rest of us. There is a reason why we need to believe in God for the very sense of reality, or the very purpose of reality. We're busy in this culture trying to take God out of everything, out of government, out of schools, out of the family, whatever. And you can't do that and have a society. You can't do that. First of all, the scriptures tell us that nations are built up for God's purpose. In fact, the whole creation was made for God's purpose. When a nation no longer serves God's purpose, he pulls it down. He says that specifically. He builds them up to begin with to serve his purpose. Everything we do, marriages, if we go into a marriage just because of lust or other, you know, values that we hold, and not for the purpose of being united with someone for the better good of serving God, of doing it better than we could by ourselves, you've missed the whole point of it, and it's doomed to fail. I mean, that's evident. You look at older folks in church that have been married for 60 years, people that believe in God and they know the purpose of marriage. And you look at the people in the world and they get, you know, married for, you know, because of love or whatever. They have no idea what love is and how it's supposed to serve them and that them serve it. And so their marriages last only a couple of years and they fall away. Life falls apart without God in it, without his purpose in life. And so what he's calling us for is to a higher way of thinking. And people may think that they have a better way or they can do it naturally or whatever. It's the same mindset that Thomas Paine had when he wrote Common Sense. For him, it was just logical for people to be moral and good people. And he said, you know, he acquired his own sense of that naturally. And people look at that and go, well, see, you know, Thomas Paine, you know, one of the founding, you know, beginners of this country, you know, that's what he said. But we don't read the correction. When Ben Franklin took him aside and said, no, you didn't get the way you are morally by your common sense. You got that way because your parents were God-fearing and they brought you up that way. And as we see more and more children being raised without godly parents, we see the parents progress, or the children progressively get worse than the parents. Until there's no morals or sense of right or wrong or anything in them. And if you don't believe that, just look at the headlines every single morning now. What goes on in this country and around the world. Sometimes we're so jaded by it that we don't realize the magnitude of it. One of the worst serial killers in history was Jack the Ripper. You know how many people he killed? 7. We got people in this country that, you know, their number of their kills is way over 100. That's how bad the moral fiber of this country is getting. And this is something we have to fight against. We have to get the word out. We have to start teaching people. We have to start taking a stand and say no more. We have to argue, you know, as we're trying to do in this lesson, even using the tools that science gives us to argue against the pseudoscience that would degrade a person's mentality. What God is calling you to do is to a higher calling. We've always, you know, put it that way. It is a higher calling. To be a better person, a higher thinking person, a more moral person, a more godly person. That's what God calls you to. And whatever you have to suffer in this life, you know, in order to promote that and to be that, God has promised he will more than compensate you for whatever you suffer through. And in the end, the reward will be far greater than you could ever imagine. You know, we said that this morning. Heaven is hard to imagine. But it is something that is absolutely glorious, beautiful, and worth being a part of for eternity. So the invitation is extended. If you want to begin serving God at this time, to be that kind of person that is, you know, a light in the world, a statesman, as we put it this morning, you know, for God's kingdom, you know, to put the right things first over everything else and our own personal wants, then has anybody ever seen The Man of La Mancha? Okay, about Don Quixote fighting windmills. The theme song to it is something that's sort of interesting, where it talks about to dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, you know, to bear the unbearable sorrow, to run where the great brave do not go. It describes a Christian, and not as someone tilting windmills, but someone who lives a life in service to God. You know, if you want the greatest purpose in life, serve God. The invitation is extended. Won't you come as we stand to sing?